Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Bennett, and each week at this time, I bring you exciting new guests to talk about various aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. And boy, there is a lot to talk about. This is a really exploding area, and I'm finally really excited to see a lot of this stuff is becoming mainstream. So it's a pretty exciting time to be a paranormal researcher. I hope you all enjoyed our guest last week. His name was Victor Vigiani, and he is the director of Exopolitics in Toronto, Canada. Exopolitics meaning extraterrestrial and human relations. Very, very interesting guest. He had quite a bit of information to share, and I was really pleased to have him on the show. But tonight, we're moving to a different topic, which is also just hugely popular right now, and that is basically the paranormal. Our guest is Larry Flaxman, and he is the president and senior researcher of the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team, the acronym being ARPAST, A-R-P-A-S-T. And Larry has actually been involved in paranormal research and hands-on field investigations for quite some time, over a decade, and he is involved in law enforcement and information technology, so he's really an ideal person to investigate this kind of stuff. And he brings, basically, his technical, scientific, and investigative background together to scientifically and objectively investigate various anomalous phenomena. He's actually the president and senior researcher of ARPAST, which he founded in February of 2007, and under his leadership, this organization has become one of the nation's largest and most active paranormal research organizations, with more than 150 members worldwide who are conducting research into the paranormal using scientific methodology. This is so important. Very, very exciting stuff. Larry actually supervises a staff of fully trained researchers and uses over $250,000 worth of top-of-the-line technology to investigate this stuff. So he also serves as technical advisor for several other paranormal research groups throughout the United States. I know this is a long introduction, but I'd like our listeners to know about our guest, because he's really quite accomplished in this field. His research has been featured in numerous newspapers, magazines, and journals, as well as on many television shows and radio shows. And he's authored several articles regarding science and the paranormal, and is a columnist for the Paranormal Awareness Society newsletter. And currently, he is the author with, a co-author actually, with Marie D. Jones, who was actually a guest on this show in the past. He's an author with Marie Jones of the upcoming books, 1111, The Time Prompt Phenomena, The Meaning Behind Mysterious Signs, Sequences, and Synchronicities, and The Resonance Key, exploring the links between vibration, consciousness, and the zero-point grid, which are being published by New Page Books. So I'm really excited to have this guest on tonight that he would join my humble little show. So, Larry, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
So you've been involved in this field for quite some 10 years, about. So how did you get involved in paranormal research? I mean, as someone who's involved in law enforcement.
Well, you know, I wish I had some sort of a wonderful story to tell you about really what got me interested in it, but truth be told, there isn't one. My entire life I've been interested in unexplained things, whether it was reading about UFOs at an early age, reading about the pyramids, reading about Easter Island, you know, just trying to come to grips with the unexplained phenomena of our wonderful world. So I don't really have any story of what got me interested in paranormal. I think as I've gotten older, the realization of my own mortality has sort of maybe pushed me in the direction of researching the paranormal, just because, you know, the prescient question that everybody wants to know is, is there something else when you die? You know, is this it? Right. So that, I guess that's really kind of what has been the genesis of my interest in this, but it's a very interesting field, definitely.
Well, and what inspired you to found the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies team and really, you know, take this to the next step?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time now. I've been affiliated with a couple of other groups, but I really believe that it was time to start an organization that was 100% science-based. You hear that term bandied around a lot by organizations that are out there. Every group wants to claim that they follow scientific methodology, but if you actually look at it beneath the surface, they don't. Most groups have very little education when it comes to what science, the scientific method actually involves. So I really wanted to have an organization that was differentiated from everything that's out there by two things. First of all, by the usage of technology. I think that's probably one of the greatest assets that we have now. And also by utilizing proper scientific methodology. You know, not just using the buzzword, but actually following it, you know, which includes a whole host of things, documentation, repeatability, creating hypotheses. There's a lot of things that go into that. So I really wanted an organization that was focused completely on the science of the paranormal, more so than, you know, the psychic aspect or the metaphysical or New Age. I really wanted to study it from a scientific black and white perspective.
All right. Well, I think that's what we need to do to, you know, convince the skeptics for one thing and, you know, get people to take this whole field of research seriously,
mm-hmm.
or more seriously than it is being taken. So I totally agree with you. But now, does that mean you would not bring psychics on, say, into a haunted house?
Absolutely not. We do not work with psychics. We do not do Ouija boards, cleansings, any of that New Age paranormal gobbledygook. We don't do that. From a scientific perspective, there is no way to be completely sure of the results from a psychic, obviously. I mean, you know, you can have some objective experiences from them, but you have no way of actually positively identifying what they're saying is true or not. So, no, we do not work with psychics. That's one of our ground rules, is we do not do that.
All right. Well, I just wondered, because that's what several groups are doing now. And,
mm-hmm.
It's interesting. So, it's technology. I mean, what kind of technology are... Technology is growing so fast these days with computers and all that, and these new EMF detectors. And so what kind of technology are you using to bring to the study of the paranormal, the unseen?
Well, let me kind of back up a little bit and tell you a little bit about what our charter is, and then I think you could probably understand what we actually do first. We are
okay.
Not a ghost hunting group. You know, a lot of organizations, that's their main tenet, is that they are a ghost hunting group, and we are not a ghost hunting group. What we do, we're interested in the paranormal, and yes, we are, I guess you would say, looking for ghosts, but that's really not our prime charter. What we do is we look for environmental conditions that may be related to a paranormal event. So what we actually do is we're studying environmental aspects of a haunting more so than we are the actual haunting itself. So the equipment that we use a wide variety of equipment, both custom designed and a lot of off-the-shelf but modified equipment. We're basically looking at environmental conditions, and we're looking at correlations between an event that occurs in one location versus an event that occurs in another location. We're looking for similarities. We're looking for things that are different. We're looking for anything in the environment that might help us to determine, you know, what's causing the phenomena, first of all, and second of all, is it repeatable based on the environmental conditions? So with that being said, the technology aspect, what we're primarily looking at is environmental conditions. We use a tremendous amount of state-of-the-art equipment. Every investigation, when we initially go in, we'll do what's called initial baseline readings. And the baseline readings consist of approximately 80 different environmental conditions that we're logging initially. So we go into a location, we're going to determine from those 80 environmental variables. We're going to determine exactly what the environmental landscape of that particular location is. Once we've done that, then we actually conduct, we can actually conduct the investigation where we use more equipment to determine if there's things that are, if there's any flux or variance in those variables that we captured before.
Right. Well, as a scientific organization, I'm sure you have to approach your investigations from a sort of a skeptical angle, but there can be a fine line between skepticism and debunking, and I'm just wondering, do you ever have cases where you are not a, where you conclude that this is a ghost, or do you just leave the question open to what it is that's causing these paranormal phenomena?
We leave it open. That's actually an excellent question. I had a reporter ask me that a couple of weeks ago, and you know, that's an excellent question. I don't think with our current level of knowledge that either my organization or any organization for that matter can definitively 100% say that a location is haunted. No matter what equipment you have, no matter what training you have, no matter what experience you have, we're still dealing with an unknown, the unknown being the paranormal event. So to actually go into a location, and regardless of your personal beliefs, and if you're looking at this from a scientific perspective, you really need to put your personal beliefs to the side. You need to look at black and white data points. You need to look at facts. If you look at the facts, there has not been anything of that has the validity to be able to show that what you have discovered is 100% proof of the paranormal. So no. We do not tell a homeowner or a location owner that their property, you know, is haunted or not. We'll present them with the final report of our investigation. We'll show them the environmental conditions that we had found that were either higher or lower than normal. We'll show them some possible explanatory causes. You know, 9 times out of 10, the investigations that we do have very prosaic explanations for what they are, whether it's a improperly grounded breaker box, whether it's a hot water heater that's not grounded, etc. There's generally a very prosaic and boring explanation for the phenomena that they're experiencing.
Right,
so
we
present that to the individuals, and we let them make up their own mind. Let them decide if they believe that it's haunted or if they believe, you know, that they're having these experiences. But we present to them the scientific fact of what's going on.
So, I mean, if 9 out of 10 are prosaic, then there's that 1%, or what, 10%, that is, I guess you would call it open to interpretation.
Yeah, absolutely. We've definitely had some investigations where, you know, at the end of it, I'm kind of scratching my head thinking, what just happened? But it's very, very rare, very rare. You know, I have a famous quote of the investigations that it's long periods of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror. And that really is true. Most investigations, what you see on TV is not indicative of a real paranormal investigation. The TV shows are great. They've introduced a lot of public awareness for what we do, but they're not indicative of an actual investigation. You know, they show 5 minutes of equipment set up, and then they show nonstop action, and it's just not like that. You know, we'll go into a location. It'll take 2-3 hours to set up the equipment, and then, you know, you sit around all night, and nothing happens. And, you know, obviously that wouldn't sell advertising if we were to, you know, broadcast that, but that's the reality of it. I mean, for the most of the time, nothing happens at all, and that's just, you know, that's just the way that it is. So the small percentage of times that something does happen, it's pretty exciting. But again, you cannot say with 100% definition that what you've experienced is something paranormal. It's something you may not be able to explain presently. But that doesn't mean that it's a ghost per se.
Right. Well, if you had to categorize the ones that are open to interpretation or unexplained, I mean, are these mostly ghostly type phenomena, or I mean, what kind of cases are you mostly investigating?
Most of the cases that we have that we do a lot of follow up cases on those. We'll do a lot of follow up return visits to those locations. But a lot of those that we've termed open investigations, where the case is still open, are generally of the personal experience type. They're generally experiential data more so than actual hard-coded environmental data that we've been able to capture. So if a person has a personal experience, for instance, somebody sees something, or somebody feels something, or somebody smells something, that would be categorized as a personal experience. Now, that would not be valid from a scientific methodology perspective, because it's not black and white data. It's a personal experience. But, you know, again, if it's an unexplainable, then, you know, that kind of brings in the whole possibility of is there a psychological aspect to the paranormal?
Right.
So you never know.
Well, I mean, what about like UFOs? Do you investigate those type of things, or I mean, like a wide wide of a variety?
We actually in our past do not do we don't do UFOs. We generally focus specifically on paranormal events. However, the organization that Marie Jones and I have started, it's called Paraexplorers, and it's kind of a, I guess you would call it the fringe investigative arm of our past. In other words, we're using the resources of our past, the technology and our methodology, to explore some of the more fringe topics like UFOs, cryptozoology, other unexplained phenomena that does not fall within the lines of paranormal. So I would say that we're not doing it under RPAS, but we are doing it under Paraexplorers.
Cool. All right. Well, what kind of technology did you say you use? I mean, you use cameras, and do you use, like, heat sensors, and what's the
lineup that you got? We have about $250,000 worth of equipment. We have a tremendous amount of our equipment is custom-built for us. We have two NASA engineers from Houston, actually, that are assigned to the space shuttle program, so we literally have rocket scientists working for us that help us design, prototype, and build quite a bit of our custom equipment. But we use everything from zero lux infrared cameras. We have a FLIR thermal imaging device, which is, you know, a lot of people consider that the holy grail of ghost hunting. We have one of those. Actually, we have two of those. We have two thermal imagers. We've got every environmental logging gadget that you could think of. We have custom magnetometers. We've got remote deployable EMF sensors. We have anything that you could possibly think of. I mean, it's so ridiculous with the amount of equipment that we have that we actually have a log, and you can see it on our website. You can see the amount of equipment that we have. I mean, it gets to the point where people will ask me, and I'm like, do we have that? And then I have to refer back to the sheet to see if we actually do or not, because we generally do. We have scientists and consultants that we work with that give us suggestions as far as the type of equipment and the type of data that we should be logging. So in conjunction with the consultants and the scientists that we have, we will tailor the investigatory methodology as far as equipment to that. So if one of our consultants says, you know, you need a three-dimensional imaging EMF meter, okay, if there's not something like that available off the shelf, then that's something that we'll go to our rocket scientists for, and we'll see if it's feasible to design and build something like that.
Right.
So we try to really differentiate ourselves from, you know, other groups with a variety of methods. But, I think the technology and our training on the use of our technology is probably our biggest differentiator. We truly believe that what we are looking at, which, again, is environmental conditions, can be studied by technology versus people that are studying strictly paranormal events, or they're strictly calling themselves ghost hunters. You don't know what they're studying. They don't know what they're studying versus we actually know we are studying environmental conditions.
Right. You sound like the most fully equipped, technologically speaking, team that's out there doing this kind of work. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I believe we are.
Wow. So have you been able to capture what you would consider, you know, hard evidence of the paranormal?
We have. We've actually gotten several. We've done several investigations where we have captured what we believe to be, you know, fairly substantial proof of the paranormal. But with that being said, there will never be 100% proof, no matter what. You know, even if a ghost stood in front of you, right in front of you, and screamed in your face, "I'm a ghost," what's to say that what you just experienced is not something psychological versus something actually in reality?
Well, if there's two witnesses and it's recorded on camera, wouldn't that be enough? If there's multiple witnesses and it's also recorded?
No, It wouldn't. The reason behind that is no photographic, no video, and no auditory evidence will ever be completely believable as evidence. Just because of the fact that, first of all, it's really, really easy to fake things. You know, you've probably seen lots of that stuff on the internet. People will fake things all the time. It's getting more and more difficult to determine stuff that's been faked out there. I mean, with the technology, with Photoshop and some of the video editors and stuff, I mean, it's the CGI animation, stuff that's being done with that, it is getting very, very difficult to determine that. Secondly, what's to say that what you captured on video or audio was not some type of anomaly with the device itself? I mean, you always have the possibility of outside interference. There could have been a, you know, a stray EM field that came through. There could have been a natural explanation of equipment malfunction. There could have been something that could have caused what you got. There's been lots and lots of photographic evidence throughout the years that's been presented as paranormal evidence, but it's either been debunked or there's never been able to be any type of conclusive proof that that's truly what it was. So, you know, it's kind of a catch-22. We keep on doing this. Well, I would say we. Most of the groups out there, the way that they're currently operating, they keep on doing the exact same thing. And, you know, paranormal investigation's been being done since the late 1800s during the spiritualist movement. You know, that's really when paranormal investigation really started.
Right.
And the methodology of groups today is really no different than it was 100 years ago. I mean, they're looking for the same things, and they're looking in the same places. That's really one of the reasons why we wanted to be different. We didn't want to look in the same place because there's been no proof. You know, 100, 150 years of doing the same thing with no evidence really should tell you something, that you're not doing something right, or you're looking in the wrong place. So that's why we decided we wanted to look at the environmental conditions, thinking maybe there's something else to this entire phenomena, and we're not looking in the right place. So we have what we believe to be good evidence of paranormal, but I wouldn't say that it's 100% verifiable to everybody. And I don't think, you know, until mainstream science wakes up and really takes this seriously, this is just going to be a fringe field, and there's right. not going to be people that are going to believe no matter what. No matter if that ghost is standing in front of you and you photograph him 100 times and he screams at you, I'm a ghost, there's people out there that will still not believe that.
Oh, don't I know it. You know,
it's probably a lot like the UFO field. You know, I'm pretty familiar with MUFON and a lot of what goes on in the UFO field as well. It's a personal interest of mine. So I know you guys run into the exact same thing, you know, the disbelievers and the skeptics. You may have the best piece of evidence ever, the best photo ever, but it's going to be, you know, people are not going to believe it.
Right. Well, the truth is the truth. And, I mean, if something's out there, the truth is eventually, you know what I mean?
Eventually. That's absolutely right.
So, well, everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett. And tonight, our guest is Larry Flaxman, who is the president of the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team, ARPAST. And there is a website that you guys can go to if you'd like to learn more about ARPAST. It's www.arpast.org. ARPAST.org. And there's lots of interesting stuff there for everyone to look up. And remember, this is a call-in show, so if anyone out there has a question or a comment or would like to share an experience, here's the toll-free number. I'll give it to you right now, so grab your pen. It's 888-228-4494. I'll repeat that, 888-228-4494. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, now, Larry, what do you tell, you know, when you go out to a case and you realize that this is not paranormal, and how do you break the news to the witness who is, you know, wrapped up in this whole incident?
We've actually had several cases like that. It seems lately, especially some of the historic locations that we've investigated, that it's been more about attention for the location than anything. People have really used the fact that we're a TAPS family member, that we're as well known as we are. You know, we'll show up and we'll do the investigation, and the entire town will be waiting for us.
Wow.
In those cases, some of these investigations that we've done, obviously there's nothing there. It's you know, completely in the owner's head, and they were just primarily getting us out there for the attention. In those specific cases, you know, what can you do but tell them the truth? You know, you can present them, and we do, we present the final report of the investigation, and, you know, here's what we found, here's what we didn't find, and, you know, you make up your own mind. Generally, in cases like that, you know, obviously there is nothing for the most part, but, you know, whether you tell them that you believe it's haunted or whether you tell them that you believe it's not haunted, they're still going to believe what they want to believe, regardless.
Right.
So,
what?
Honesty is always the best policy.
I asked because I once was on a case where to investigate a UFO sighting, which was apparently appearing day after day, and I went up there and saw it was planes, and had to go back to the witnesses and tell them that what they were seeing was, you know, jets coming towards them, so it looked like it was hovering in the sky, and then they would turn and go behind the mountains. They were not happy about it, and basically did not believe me. So I
think that's probably a pretty common response. You know, if somebody has it in their mind set, you know, that this is the way it is, that no matter what you say and how much of an expert that you are, they're just going to believe what they want to believe.
Right, which is almost worse, I think, probably even worse than, you know, skepticism, because, I mean, blind belief.
Oh, absolutely, sure. Sure it is.
So the work you're doing is pretty important. Then, well, then, where do you get your cases? I mean, especially when you began, how did you build up, you know, all these cases that you've investigated?
The vast majority of our cases come from referrals. People know about us from our advertising. We've had advertising run in local papers. We've got brochures, business cards, all that stuff. So a lot of the investigations come from just word of mouth, from people knowing about us around town, around the state. A lot of it also comes from TAPS. We get a tremendous amount of referrals from them. They get people that email them all the time, and then they forward the cases to us. So a little bit of both. And we also have a lot of cases where we actually make the initial contact, places specifically that we want to investigate that maybe haven't contacted us or don't know about us. So we stay really busy with the investigations. Right now we are booked solid with 3 investigations a month through December.
Wow.
And it's been like that since March. So we're actually scheduling people now into January and February of next year. And it's, you know, it makes it very difficult, especially for the cases where homeowners will contact us and they believe that there is some sort of a bad entity or something in their house, and they really want some help trying to explain what's going on. And it really puts a lot of stress on us because we have to, you know, try to juggle things around and figure out if we can accommodate them within a reasonable amount of time. But yeah, we stay really, really busy with the investigations. It really has gotten to the point now where all we're doing is strictly people that are contacting us. We don't even have time to be contacting other places. We started out contacting locations of places that we wanted to investigate, but now we're so busy with people contacting us for investigations that we don't even do it.
Right. Well,
I think it's probably a good thing. You know, that's probably a good thing for us. But
would you say most of your cases are local? I mean, do you investigate across the United States?
Yeah, we do. We investigate across the U.S. The vast majority of our cases, though, are in the Southwest. We primarily do Arkansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Tennessee. You know, with gas pushing $4 a gallon and this not being a full-time job for anyone, you know, it's really hard to go beyond beyond those states, especially, you know, with, like I said, the way gas is right now. So,
right.
Yeah, we've done some stuff nationwide. We've got an investigation in California that we're working on. We've got something that we're trying to do as a joint investigation with another group at Coal Castle in Florida. And
Oh, wow. We
do it, but lately, just with the amount of with our workload and everything, we try to stay within that Southwest area.
All right. So do you categorize your cases when you, I mean, file them in your database?
We do, actually. That's an excellent question. We have a custom relational database that we use. We have a database called, well, actually, we have 2 databases that we use. One system, we have a case management system, which is custom designed by us. It's called Paratracker. and we're the only ones in the country that use something of this manner. It is a case management system. It allows us to manage all of the aspects of our case, from initial contact information with the individual to the initial interview questions that we ask them, everything. It allows us to keep a standardized database, basically, of case information. What ties into that is our relational database called SOCIUS, and SOCIUS is a SQL database that we use where we log all of the data points that we gather during the investigation. Remember when I talked about how we've logged 80 different environmental conditions during baselines? All of those 80 environmental points are logged into SOCIUS. Most of the equipment that we use is data logging. In other words, it'll record, it'll automatically log into in PC format, where you just plug it into a PC and it dumps the data that it recorded. SOCIUS takes all of these pieces of information that we gathered, puts it into different tables within the database, and then it allows us to do cross-correlative searches among locations based on the phenomena. So we can look at one investigation that we did in Hot Springs, Arkansas, May 12, 2008, and then compare it to one that we did in Charleston, South Carolina, you know, back in 2007. And we can see environmentally what was the same, what was different, are there any correlations between those two locations, whether it's geographic, whether it's environmental, whether it's, you know, whether it's really anything. It allows us, that we've logged, allows us to look for those correlations. And what we're looking for using that database is we're looking for things that could be reproducible. In other words, ultimately, we'd like to be able to say, based on what we found at these locations, we predict that if we find a location that matches these variables, then there's a possibility that this might also occur. So that's right. Kind of the ultimate. That's what we're really looking for. And from a scientific perspective, that's called repeatability, and that's really what we're looking for. We're trying to have a phenomenon that's repeatable, that we can predict it with some manner of efficiency or some manner of accuracy. So the two databases that we use, the case management system and then our actual data log database, are absolutely integral to our work. We would not be able to keep track of the vast, vast amounts of data that we log without those two things. Very, very, very impressive pieces of software.
Very exciting. So, well, let's consider the meat of some of these cases. I mean, like, what was your most exciting case that turned out to be, unexplained? I mean, do you ever get, like, scared doing this work? Has anything ever happened that freaked you out?
I plead the Fifth Amendment on that one. No, yeah, I have. I mean, I'll be honest. Yeah, there's been investigations that I've been on where, you know, I've either gotten myself worked up into a tizzy, or, you know, the other individuals around me have, you know, it's kind of a mass, where we all kind of get ourselves into it. Yeah, there's been occasions where we've all gotten ourselves scared. It's pretty few and far between. Like I mentioned before, you know, most of our investigations they're pretty boring. You pretty much either sit around watching monitors and watching the equipment, or, you know, you ask EVP questions or whatever. There's really not a whole lot of excitement. With that being said, yeah, I've definitely had some personal experiences. You know, I had an experience back in, was it October, I guess it was? Yeah, October, where we got what we believed to be a full-bodied apparition on the FLIR thermal camera. We captured what looks to be a full-bodied apparition, and we had the experience lasted for a good 45 minutes before it disappeared. But we got that, we had that logged, we had that recorded. That was actually kind of freaky. That actually was probably one of the scarier, I guess you would say, incidents too, or more interesting experiences. I guess I'll tell you kind of the beginning part of it. It was at a sanatorium in the northwest portion of the state, and I don't know if you're familiar with what sanatoriums are, but they when you were back at when these places were built. When you were diagnosed with having tuberculosis, you were sent to what's called a sanatorium. And a sanatorium was basically a place to go die. They would do experimental tests on you, experimental procedures, but it was very low success rate during those times. That was before antibiotics and before they really had an effective method of treatment.
Wow.
So this particular location is one of the larger sanatoriums in the country. There's been, people have said, anywhere from 2,500 to 25,000 people that have passed away in this particular location. It's a very humbling place. I mean, you walk in, it's five stories high, and there's 512 beds, I believe it is. Very, very large place. We're winding down the investigation for the night, and we were on the second floor of this place, just kind of hanging out. And one of the other individuals in my group, the co-founder, was looking down the hallway with the FLIR thermal camera, and she said, "Do you see that?" And I'm looking at the camera, and I said, "No, I don't see anything." And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, you know, we're all tired, it's hot, you know, nothing's happened all night, let's call it a night. And she's like, "No, I swear, I just saw something." And, you know, coming from her, she's a very skeptical person, definitely a skeptical individual. So I gave her the benefit of the doubt. I said, "You know, I don't see what you're seeing, but let's just sit here for a few more minutes and see if anyone else sees it." It was a joint investigation with another group, too. We had probably about 25 people that were there total at this point. So we're all looking at the monitor on the thermal camera, and we're trying to see what she's seeing. And a few people see it, and a few people don't. And, of course, I've got my beliefs in the psychological aspect of this, but I'm keeping my mouth shut at this point. She's still telling me that she sees something. I don't. So, you know, I'm getting tired of her saying she sees something and I'm not having any of the fun. So I decided to walk out down the hallway to where she was seeing what she thought she was seeing. So I walked down about 25 feet and she told me to stop. And I stopped. And I'm looking around and, you know, this is a dark hallway. You know, there's patient rooms on either side of the hall and that's pretty much all you can see. So I stopped where I was, and she's down there yelling at me. She's like, "Stand still. She's right in front of you." And I'm like, "Okay, whatever." So I stand still, and she, Tiffany is yelling back to me that she said that she's looking up at you. And everybody else back there at this point, you know, I'm hearing all kinds of oohs and ahs back there. I guess other people are seeing this. But, of course, you know, I'm standing there in front of everyone looking like an idiot and not seeing anything. So I get down on my knees just for a second. And Tiffany said that she's dancing around you. She said that she thought that she and everybody else in the group at this point was seeing what they believed to be a little child that was kind of dancing around me while I was kind of stooped down. Well, at that point, when she told me that, I was like, okay, I'm done with this. That's just ridiculous, the skeptical side of me coming out. So right. I stood back up, and I stepped forward, and I took two steps when all of a sudden I walked through what can literally be described as a wall of ice. I have never in my life had anything like that happen before, but, you know, you hear about cold spots and people walking through cold spots. This was much more than that. This was like walking through, it was like going from a sauna to a freezer. It was an instant temperature drop.
Wow.
And at this point, I'm hearing Tiffany and everybody else down there just start to freak out. So I run down there, and Tiffany is just absolutely going nuts. She said, "What happened?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, "I felt something really, really cold, and I walked right through it, and every hair on my body stood up. But other than that, I don't know what that was." Tiffany said, "Well, whatever it was that you just walked through completely obliterated your thermal signature on the thermal camera. And if you know anything about thermal cameras, when you image a human body, you see lots and lots of red, basically, because our body produces heat. So you see a lot of red, a tremendous amount of red. Whatever that was, that localized cold field that I walked through completely obliterated my thermal signature." So, anyways, to make a really long story short, we've got about 45 minutes of footage from the thermal camera, and I still can't see the little girl. But once I got back, when everyone was freaking out, there also appears, to the left of where they're seeing the little girl, there appears to be a full-grown man. And the full-grown man, to me, is very, very clear. You can actually make out where he crosses his arms, and then he looks down, and then he kind of looks up. And that's very, very clear. But I never still, to this day, I still can't definitively see the little girl, but I can see the full-size man that was standing to her left. So that was probably one of the most interesting experiences. You know, we've got video proof as well as my personal experience that occurred there.
Right. Well, that's pretty exciting. I'm personally convinced that these are ghosts. I think the evidence is pretty darn overwhelming. But what other interpretation? I mean, do you have theories that you raise other than ghosts? Then for something like that, I mean,
there's a lot of possibilities. you know, the one side of me wants to say yes, it was a ghost that I experienced. It was, you know, I walked through some sort of a spectral residue of a ghost or whatever. But you know, then the rational side of me says, you know, really, there's no proof. You know, I had the personal experience, and you can see something on the thermal camera, which may just be us matrixing. It may just, you know, there's a phenomenon called pareidolia, and I'm sure you're probably familiar with that from the UFO field.
Right.
But for those that aren't, it's basically, you can look up in the clouds. It's just like when you look up in the clouds and you can see, you know, boats, or you can see shapes in the clouds. The human brain has a tendency to put patterns together from nothing. It's a survival mechanism that we've had since the caveman times. So, you know, I look at the thermal image and I think maybe I'm just matrixing that image. Maybe it's just strictly pareidolia and I'm just being a little bit influenced by the fact that I had a personal experience. But, you know, I believe that there is something. I believe that when you shuffle off of this mortal coil, that's not all. You know, if you look at things from a traditional scientific, if you look at it from the Edwardian scientific perspective, if you look at the first law of thermodynamics and the second law of thermodynamics, the first law stating basically that matter cannot be created nor destroyed. So if the human body, which is a generator of electricity, we can measure that. We have devices that we use where we can actually measure the microvoltage that's produced by a human body. If the human body embodies... Oh, that was kind of cool. The human body embodies an electrical current. In other words, perhaps it's our soul that is actually electric, that has a current to it or has energy to it. Going by the first law of thermodynamics, that would not be able to be destroyed upon our death. If you move into the second law of thermodynamics, that basically states that the energy can merely be transferred into another. It can merely be transferred, whether it transfers into stasis or whether it transfers into another form, that's basically what happens. So if you put the two things together, you look at the two laws of thermodynamics and you apply that to paranormal phenomena, when you die, and of course this is all theoretical, but when you die, the energy of your body either dissipates, which is a possibility, or it transfers into another medium. Really, if you think about that and you think about the implications of what that could mean, I mean, that's pretty vast and far-ranging.
Oh, yeah.
That could explain a lot of residual hauntings, you know, people that have had specific repeatable actions that of a haunting nature. It could. There's a lot of possibilities with that. But if you look at it from the scientific perspective, I think science is telling us that, yes, there is proof of this. If you look at the scientific principles or the physics principles behind it, yes, there is proof. We've just not been able to find it definitively yet.
Right. Well, what would you say is like the most bizarre case that you were sure was, you know, a hot one that was really unexplained that turned out to be prosaic?
You want a really weird one or one that just turned out to be prosaic? I mean, I can give you both. I've had really strange ones.
Yeah,
well, probably one of the more strange ones was an individual that had contacted us that wanted to have his apartment investigated, and didn't really know anything about the experiences that he was having. He didn't want to talk over the phone. He wanted to do everything in person. So we show up, and the first thing that we learn is that he's having nighttime visits from two female succubi.
Oh, no.
In other words, two female ghosts, and that he's having sexual relations with the two of them. And he's going into very explicit detail about his relations with these two spirits. And he didn't want us to get rid of them. We don't do that. I mean, we're not Ghostbusters. We don't do cleansings or any of that New Age garbage. He didn't want to get rid of them. What he wanted was he wanted to be able to choose when it would occur. he wanted to be able to, in other words, instead of getting it every night, which is what was happening, he wanted to be able to, you know, say, hey, I only want it, you know, once or twice a week instead of every night. So that was one of the stranger ones. We had another guy that contacted us that had a werewolf in his shower, wanted us to come investigate that. You know, we've had all kinds. We did one 2 months ago that we got up there, and we're doing the investigation, and it was weird from the beginning. I mean, we showed up at the door, we knocked on the door, the daughter answered the door, and she just kind of stood there for a second, and we said, you know, we're all past, and she's like, oh, come in. So we come in, and she walks back to the back bedroom where her mother was, and you hear all kinds of screaming and yelling, and then like 5 minutes later, the mother comes up front, and she's like, just do whatever you want to do. So we're like, okay, so we start setting up our equipment, and next thing you know, it ends up being one of the other members in the group is a cop too, and we both had some experience with drug identification, and we both had our thoughts that, you know, these people are extremely high, and we were setting up equipment, and our camera guy was in the bathroom, setting up one of our cameras in the bathroom, and he found on the floor there was a rock of methamphetamine on the floor.
Oh, jeez.
It was at that point that we decided, you know, hey, we need to leave and time to call the cops. So, you know, you get all kinds. I mean, there's attention-seeking people that just want their name in the paper or on TV. There's people that, you know, that really just don't want any type of promotion at all. You know, those, to me, are probably the most legitimate. The ones that tell us, you know, please don't show up at my house with, you know, the vans and the cars with the big stickers on the side. You know, let's try to keep it as quiet as possible. But, you know, then there's also the ones where you show up and the whole neighborhood greets you. So we've got all kinds. I mean, it is never a dull moment with this. I don't know if it's that paranormal investigation just seems to attract some weird people, but, you know, we get all kinds of people that contact us about investigating their places. You wouldn't believe some of the stuff. You know, you would think if you were inviting strangers over to your house that you would make somewhat of an effort to maybe clean the house or maybe to hide some of the things that you didn't want other people to see. Oh no, we've had, you know, everything. We've had people that leave out sex toys and just all kinds of stuff. You wouldn't believe it. I'm actually envious. You know, being a UFO investigator, you probably don't have to deal with some of the crackpots that we do.
Oh, you'd be surprised. They're there. They're pretty, for whatever reason, the unknown, the paranormal UFOs attracts the whole crank. A lot of cranks and people who are, I don't know, just not quite all there.
I wonder why that is. You know, I really wonder if there's just some psychological aspect of this whole thing that, you know, just makes it more, I don't know. I just don't understand it. Don't forget, there's all kinds of weirdos out there. I mean, you know, with that being said, though, we do get a lot of legitimate calls as well. I mean, the weirdos are definitely the minority, but boy, when we get them, they are just way out there.
Well, how many cases has your team investigated in
Over
total?
The past year, we've done probably about 100.
Wow, that's a lot.
So, and I've been doing this a long time before our past. So I couldn't even keep track of how many that I've done. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds.
Well, as a professional, I mean, does this affect your career? And what about your family? How do they feel about this, your research, I mean?
Other than traveling a lot on the weekends, they think it's great. You know, my wife is not, I wouldn't say she's necessarily a believer, but she's had some experiences that she can't explain. So she's not totally against it, but, you know, if we go to a really cool place out of state or out of the city or whatever, a lot of times I'll take her with me and she'll come check it out. She always likes checking out new places.
And you have two books upcoming?
We do. Marie Jones and myself have two books, both being published by New Page. We've got a book, our first one, which thankfully we're almost done writing. It's called 1111, and it talks about number sequences and sacred geometry. It's been a very interesting topic. That was actually something that I thought was going to be unbelievably boring when we started it. I'm not a huge math guy, other than, you know, what I took in college and stuff. And I never really fancied myself somebody that would be interested in writing about math and numbers, but it's been very interesting. You know, there's lots and lots of people that have had time prompt experiences of their own. I don't know if you've ever noticed, you know, if you wake up exactly 11:11 or you look at the clock and it's exactly, you know, 1:11, but, you know, that's happened to me throughout my whole life. So we're writing about that. And then the second book we're writing about is a book more tied in with paranormal than 11:11 is. It's going to be talking about resonance. And basically we have a theory of paranormal phenomena and how it kind of ties in with resonance. So look for both of those in February 2009.
Wow. And do you want to give out your website one more time?
Sure. Actually, let me give you both addresses. My website for RPAST is www.arpast.org. That's rpast.org. And then my joint collaboration with my partner Marie is www.paraexplorers.com. Paraexplorers.com. So between both of those websites, I think you'll find lots and lots of reading material. The RPAST site alone, we have well over 500 pages, lots of research information and articles and things on there for people to read.
Cool. And when is your book coming out?
February 2009. I know you can pre-order 11:11 on Amazon. I don't think they've got the other one up there yet.
Awesome. Well, Larry, that's pretty much all the time we got tonight. But wow, definitely doing some very, very interesting and important work. So, wow, I want to congratulate you on all your success doing that. So.
Anytime you're down this way in the neighborhood, let me know and we'll take you out with us.
Awesome, that would be very cool. I just might do that one of these days if I can find the time.
Okay.
Well, I guess that's our show. Thanks very much for coming on, Larry.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
All right, everyone. I hope you've enjoyed our show tonight. My name is Preston Dennett, and we've been talking to our guest, Larry Flaxman, who is the president of RPAST, the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies Team, which has quickly become one of the largest and most influential paranormal studies team out there that's approaching this from a scientific angle and doing really important work. So very, very interesting stuff. And I hope you can all join us next week when I bring on another exciting guest to talk about UFOs and the paranormal. Thank you for listening, and until next time, have a great evening and a wonderful week. Bye.
Preston? Preston?